Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Weekend Edition for Saturday, March 16th, 2024. Fire Preparedness Initiative gets $300,000. Permian Strategic Partnership investing in advanced training courses and facility partnerships. Supporting the safety of communities in the Permian Basin, both large and small, is a mission of the Permian Strategic Partnership, which has donated millions to life-saving efforts for first responders. This week, the PSP continued its support by investing $300,000 for advanced training courses and facility upgrades in partnership with the Seminole Volunteer Fire Department and the Andrews Volunteer Fire Department. Of that amount, $200,000 is allocated for courses offered by Texas A&M Extension Services, TEEX, and other accredited organizations. The remaining $100,000 will go toward enhancing fire and industrial training facilities in Andrews. The Permian Basin Regional Fire Training Initiative was formed in partnership with PSP to bring training to the Permian Basin. Training sessions are scheduled at facilities throughout the Permian Basin, including in Midland and Odessa, with efforts underway to add locations in Eddy County, New Mexico. The majority of the classes and the academy will take place in Andrews and Seminole. Officials highlight the Hybrid Fire Academy as the main driver of this initiative. It will receive a portion of the $300,000 investment. The academy offers a flexible and efficient path for volunteers to become certified firefighters within 6 months, a significant improvement over the typical certification process, which can be challenging for volunteers balancing jobs and family commitments. Specialized training for handling oil field-related emergencies is also being made available. Addressing the unique risks such as fires, explosions, toxic gas releases, and equipment malfunctions. This training is essential in the Permian Basin, requiring a specific skill set and knowledge for effective management. Quote, we are working with TEEX to bring a class to the area called Industrial Emergencies for Municipal-Based Responders, end quote. Seminole Fire Chief D.A. Dagley told the Reporter Telegram by email. Quote, this class will provide area firefighters with the knowledge and hands-on training needed for responses to the oil and gas industry. This class is traditionally done in College Station, and we are excited to make it available locally to area first responders, end quote. Standoff ends in man's arrest. A Midland man is in custody, and two hostages are safe, after the standoff at Sundance Creek Apartments ended early Friday morning. According to a warrant of arrest obtained from the Justice of the Peace, Christian Armani Milan, 40, of Midland, was arrested for aggravated kidnapping and sexual abuse. Milan was reportedly involved in a situation where two women were held hostage during a standoff with police at Sundance Creek Apartments. The incident, spanning from Wednesday to Friday, involved an armed subject barricading themselves and lasted over 27 hours. The Midland Police Department responded to a domestic disturbance call at building number 8 in the apartment complex Wednesday. During a welfare check, officers learned that Milan was holding hostages inside and refused to come out, triggering the standoff. Management of the apartment complex notified residents by email of a situation that was going on, relaying that the police asked they shelter in place and remain secure. Meanwhile, police officers cleared building number 8 to ensure the safety of bystanders. The city sent out an alert to media and the community at 8:45 a.m. Thursday, notifying them of a, quote, barricaded subject and hostage situation, end quote, at the apartment complex and asked residents to avoid the area until the situation was resolved. Around the same time, management notified residents that they were essentially free to go about their day, but would need to park in certain areas when returning to the complex. While the Midland Police Department were the initial agency involved in the standoff, Midland Police Deputy Chief Brian Rackow told the Reporter Telegram Thursday afternoon. He also said that Texas Department of Public Safety had taken the lead on the situation. Rackow said MPD officers were on scene overnight, and it can be detrimental to an officer's health for one unit to remain on duty for extended periods of time. The suspect, later identified as Milan, engaged with law enforcement negotiators throughout the situation. On Thursday afternoon, someone claiming to be the suspect contacted CBS 7 and gave an interview. During the call, the man presumed to be Milan told CBS 7 he was in the apartment with a woman and his daughter. He said he was holding the woman hostage for cheating on him and that he was heartbroken. Quote, "The reason is, I am not going to prison the rest of my life," end quote, the caller said to CBS 7. Quote, "I'm 39 years old, so I'd already be dead before I do 20 to 30 years, and that's not going to happen. That's a fact," end quote. Preliminary reports from law enforcement stated the man was holding two women and a child hostage. However, during a press release held after the conclusion of the situation Friday, it was revealed only two people were held hostage, the woman and a 9-year-old girl. Before the conclusion of the situation around 7:25 p.m. Thursday, Midland Mayor Lori Blong issued a statement thanking the community for stepping up to help displaced residents. Quote, "I want to thank Midlanders who have reached out to me to see what they can do regarding the hostage situation in our community," end quote, Blong said. Quote, "Also, the churches that are stepping up with ways to help those who are temporarily being displaced are a huge lift and a great way to help our fellow neighbors," end quote. On Thursday, in response to the Sundance Creek apartment standoff, the City of Midland and the Midland Police Department coordinated support for displaced residents. They took several steps. The city arranged and paid for hotel rooms for affected residents, with four units accepting the offer. Anticipating the possibility of evacuating multiple buildings, the city and Midland County activated emergency response coordination around 3:30 p.m. to potentially assist up to 66 apartment units. The Horseshoe Education Building was quickly converted into a temporary shelter, equipped with resources from the American Red Cross, including blankets, teddy bears, and hygiene kits. Through a partnership with Target Hospitality, Man Camp rooms were made available at no cost for those in need, thanks to Target Hospitality's generous support. City and county officials, including city council members and the mayor, engaged with local ministries and nonprofits to prepare additional support, such as clothing and shelters, if required. Milan is being detained at the Midland County Jail, facing a charge of aggravated kidnapping and sexual abuse, classified as a Class 1 felony. Currently, no bond has been set, and his case is awaiting further legal proceedings. MPD Deputy Chief Greg Chatwell announced at a press conference after Milan was taken into custody that the standoff began after Milan threatened his girlfriend in calls to family members. These threats prompted MPD to conduct a welfare check on Milan. During the press conference, Chatwell credited the department's working relationships with other agencies for the support and success of the arrest. Quote, "Over the last 24 hours, there have probably been over 100 people being sworn officers and all the support personnel, millions of dollars worth of equipment, Midland Police Department, Midland Fire Department, Odessa came in and relieved our folks for a while, Texas DPS, and later the FBI hostage rescue team," end quote, he said. U.S. continues to produce more oil than any country ever. Once again, the U.S. has produced more crude oil than any other country ever. An analysis released this week by the U.S. Energy Information Administration said that, according to its international energy statistics, the U.S. produced more crude oil than any nation at any time for the past 6 years in a row. U.S. crude production, including condensate, averaged 12.9 million barrels a day in 2023, breaking the previous U.S. and global record of 12.3 million barrels per day set in 2019. Average monthly U.S. crude oil production established a monthly record high this past December at more than 13.3 million barrels per day. Quote, "Texas Permian drillers were largely responsible for these record numbers, producing 5.63 million barrels per day," end quote. Ed Longenecker, president of the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association, told the Reporter-Telegram by email. Quote, "America's strong output helped stabilize global energy markets as Saudi Arabia and Russia cut their production. U.S. crude output is set to remain strong in 2024, with February reaching highs of 13.3 million B/D and and expectations for 2025 to deliver similar results, end quote. EIA analysts write that the nation's crude oil production is unlikely to be broken in any other country in the near term because no other country has reached a production capacity of 13 million barrels per day. They noted Saudi Arabia's state-owned Saudi Aramco recently scrapped plans to increase production capacity to 13 million barrels a day by 2027. Together, the United States, Russia, and Saudi Arabia accounted for 40%, 32.8 million barrels per day of global oil production in 2023, according to the EIA. These three countries have produced more oil than any other since 1971, counting production in the Russian Federation of the Soviet Union prior to 1991. Although the top spot has shifted among them over the past five decades. By comparison, the next three largest producing countries, Canada, Iraq, and China, combined produced 13.1 million barrels per day in 2023, only slightly more than what was produced in the U.S. alone. After peaking at 9.6 million barrels per day in 1970, annual U.S. crude oil production flattened and then generally declined for decades to a low of 5 million barrels per day in 2008. Crude oil production began increasing again in 2009 as producers increasingly applied hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling techniques and has increased steadily since. The only exception to U.S. production growth since 2009 was in 2020 and 2021 when demand and prices decreased because of the economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. In recent years, crude oil production in the Permian Basin drove the increases in total crude oil and natural gas production in the United States. Russia was the country with the most crude oil production in 2017, but production growth in Russia has since lagged behind the United States. Average annual production in Russia peaked in 2019 at 10.8 million barrels per day, when it trailed the U.S. by 1.4 million barrels per day. More recently, Russia was among the OPEC Plus countries that announced production cuts in November 2022 and in February 2023. It separately announced additional voluntary cuts of 500,000 barrels per day. Although voluntary cuts have reduced recent production in Russia, EIA analysts believe sanctions and voluntary actions by companies in response to the full-scale invasion of Ukraine have been the primary cause of the cuts. Actual cuts to production appear to be smaller than anticipated, however, and EIA estimates production in Russia declined by only 200,000 barrels per day in 2023. Average annual production in Saudi Arabia peaked in 2022 at 10.6 million barrels per day, which was 1.3 million barrels per day less than in the United States that year. In 2023, crude oil production in Saudi Arabia declined by about 900,000 barrels per day because of OPEC Plus cuts and further voluntary cuts Saudi Arabia made to offset weaker demand growth. Production in Saudi Arabia could not exceed the 2023 production volume in the United States because state-owned Saudi Aramco's stated production capacity is 12 million barrels per day, with about 300,000 barrels per day of additional capacity from its share of the neutral zone area shared with Kuwait. Rain runoff forces two low water crossing closures. Morning rainfall impacted two low water crossings within the city, Midland officials reported Friday morning. According to an email from the city spokesperson, the two low water crossings closed were along the Scarber Draw, Scarber and Edwards, Scarber and Barber. The Midland International Airport recorded 0.5 inches of rainfall Friday morning, with more showers expected over the weekend. The National Weather Service also took to social media to announce a mix of rain and pea-sized hail, which fell as the storms moved through the Permian Basin area. First meteorologist Anthony Franz announced the rain forecast in his weekly West Texas weather column and said that the Permian Basin area can expect to see more precipitation over the weekend. Quote, West Texas is looking at daily chances of showers and weak storms Friday and through the weekend as a low-pressure system stalls out in the desert southwest, end quote, Franz wrote. Quote, it's not expected to be heavy, as Friday's rainfall will likely only result in 1 to 2 tenths of an inch, end quote. Franz also said that the low-pressure system will stall over the area and result, quote, in additional rounds of showers for West Texas Saturday through early next week, end quote. Life Tributes, Susan Elizabeth Henderson Askins, 7/26/1944 to 3/10/2024. Susan Elizabeth Henderson Askins passed away peacefully at home in Midland, Texas, on March 10, 2024, surrounded by her loving family. She was born July 26, 1944, in Longview, Texas, to Elizabeth Ann Beth Henderson, while her father, Richard L. Henderson, was flying B-24 bombers and P-51 Mustang fighter planes over Germany during World War II. Susan is preceded in death by her father, Richard, and stepmother, Elma Jean Henderson, mother, Beth, and stepfather, Charles Pretty, brother, Rick Henderson, stepsister, June Jarrett, and stepbrothers, Bob Pretty and Charles Pretty, Jr. She is survived by her daughter, Kendall Smith, and her husband, Rusty, of Midland, son, Mason Askins, and his fiancée, April Thompson, of Midland, son, Cooper Askins, and his wife, Stephanie, of Austin, grandchildren Presley Shaw and her husband Patrick, Elizabeth Ann and Colin Smith, Elliot and Forrest Askins, great-grandson Henderson Shaw, stepsister Barbara Clark and her husband John, stepsister Susan Jarrett, stepbrother Walter Pretty and his wife Kim, Aunt Blanche Brick and her husband Bob, and numerous beloved cousins. A memorial service will be held at 11 o'clock a.m. Tuesday, March 19, 2024, at First Presbyterian Church in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Patricia Larson, 12/31/1930 to 3/14/2024. Patricia L. Larson, 93, of Champaign, died at 12:16 a.m. Thursday, March 14, 2024, at Goldwater Care Center, Gibson City, Illinois. Born in Jamestown, New York, on December 31, 1930, to Ernest and Margaret Larson. She was preceded in death by her husband, Kenneth, on March 22, 2023. She is survived by her daughter, Christina, and two sons, Thomas and Gregory, four grandchildren, and seven great-grandchildren. There will be no public services. Condolences may be offered at www.morganmemorialhome.com. Emma M. A. Carnett, 4/17/1928 to 3/14/2024. Emma M. A. Carnett, 95, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, March 14, 2024. The family will receive friends from 5 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. Monday, March 18, 2024, at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Memorial services will be at 10 o'clock a.m. Tuesday, March 19, 2024, at Fannin Terrace Baptist Church. Born in Chicago, Illinois, on April 17, 1928, M. pursued education passionately, earning her bachelor's degree in physical education and art from the University of Texas. Her enduring legacy will be remembered and celebrated by her surviving relatives, including brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law, Norm Carnett of Amarillo, Texas, Gary and Anita Carnett of Garden City, Texas, Greg and Debbie Carnett of Sherman, Texas, Vicki Carnett of San Angelo, Texas, nephew and niece, John and Yolanda Carnett of Midland, 43 nieces, nephews, great-nieces, and great-nephews. M was preceded in death by her husband, Glenn Carnett, parents Emma and Stanley Hickory, son Lane Carnett, brother Stanley and sister-in-law Robin. In lieu of flowers, please make memorial donations to a charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Charles Ray Moncrief, 8/26/1930 to 3/5/2024. Charles Ray Moncrief passed away March 5, 2024, at the age of 93, in the Good Samaritan Skilled Nursing Facility in Fort Collins, Colorado, after a decline in health due to Alzheimer's. To view the full obituary and service details, please visit www.all. NuttFtCollins.com. Shirley Ann Snyder, 421-1932 to 3-7-2024. Shirley Ann Snyder passed away on March 7, 2024, in Midland, Texas. She was 91 years old. Shirley was born on April 21, 1932, in Fostoria, Ohio, to Lucille and Howard McFadden. Shirley's husband, Bill, preceded her in death on February 3, 2024. Shirley was the ultimate mother of five children, all of whom survive her: Rebecca Becky Opperman of Lubbock, Texas; Cynthia Cindy Wagler of Midland, Texas; William B. Brad of Idaho Falls, Idaho; Dr. Warren R. Randy of San Angelo, Texas; and Joseph B. of Flat Rock, Illinois. In addition to her five children, Shirley is survived by her sisters Jane Farabee and Sandy Petrinich, as well as 13 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Kayla Lynn Rigney, 12-3-1988 to 3-2-2024. Kayla Lynn Rigney finished her earthly race on March 2, 2024, and went to be with her Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Kayla was born in Midland, Texas on December 3, 1988, to Rick and Janet Bender. Kayla is survived by her husband, Daniel William Rigney, her three children, William Andrew Rigney, Elizabeth Ellie Lynn Rigney, and Ezra Rex Rigney. Kayla is also survived by her parents, Rick and Janet Bender of Midland, Texas, her brother and sister-in-law, Bryce and Leslie Bender of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, sister Melody Bender of Midland, Texas, and grandmothers Mary Moore of Las Cruces, New Mexico, and Jan Bender of Midland, Texas. Kayla is also survived by her mother-in-law, Greta Rigney of Midland, Texas, her brother-in-law and wife, Joe and Jenny Rigney, their children, Sam, Peter, and Jack, brother-in-law and wife, Robbie and Allison Rigney, their children, Will, Luke, Hank, and Emmy. A visitation will be held in Midland, Texas on March 19th from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock p.m. at the Branch at NPW. A service will be held in Midland, Texas at Stonegate Fellowship on March 20th at 1 o'clock p.m. Another service will be held in St. Paul, Minnesota at City's Church on March 23rd at 3 o'clock p.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Thomas Ray Wolfe. Thomas Ray Wolfe, 87, of Midland, passed away Wednesday, March 13, 2024. He was born in Rising Star, Texas. The family received friends for a visitation on Friday, March 15, 2024, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home, 4616 North Big Spring Street. Funeral service will be held Saturday, March 16, 2024, at 2 p.m. at Westside Church of Christ, 4410 West Illinois Avenue, followed by burial at Rest Haven Memorial Park, 4616 North Big Spring Street. Please visit ellisfunerals.com to leave online condolences. Rachel Raymond Billheimer, 2-8-1939 to 2-23-2024. Raymond B. Billheimer, 85, faithfully completed her devoted service to our Lord on Friday, February 23, 2024, while inspecting completed Uganda water well project in eastern Uganda, Africa. Raymond was born on February 8, 1939, to Ralph Brown and Mary Payne Brown in Bonifay, Florida, where she attended Holmes County High School, graduating in 1957. Raymond is survived by her husband, Robert Jr., Bob, and son, Robert III, Bobby, sister-in-law, Jenny Brown of Farmers Branch, Texas, and nieces, Susan and Stephanie, and nephew, Reggie. A celebration of Raymond's life will be held on Wednesday, March 20th at 1:30 p.m. at First Presbyterian Church, Midland, Texas. Thomas Dale Hardaway, 11-10-1939 to 1-20-2024. Thomas Dale Hardaway, 84, of Eunice, New Mexico, passed away in Midland, Texas at 2 p.m. on Saturday, January 20th, 2024, following 4 months of battling pneumonia and COVID. A memorial service will be held on Saturday, March 23rd, 2024, at 12 o'clock noon in the chapel of First Presbyterian Church of Midland, Texas, with Pastor Steve Shore officiating. Thomas Dale was born in Monahans, Ward County, Texas, on November 10, 1939, with his twin sister Judith Gale, the second set of twins, and the youngest children born to James Houston Hardaway and Mamie Britton Hardaway. Tom and Lavelle Vance married on October 27, 1961, and were blessed with 2 children, 7 grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, and 1 great-great-grandchild to date, named as follows. Jeffrey Todd Hardaway, married to Kelly, have 5 children. Abby Demmer and spouse Kyle, who has 5 children. Emily Hardaway Wright and spouse Cutter. Mark Cedillo, who has 3 children, Eric Cedillo, Matthew Cedillo, who has 6 children and 1 great-great-grandchild. Jenna Dale Hardaway Cates, married to Clayton Cates, were blessed also with 2 children, Clayton Trey Cates III and Braylon R. Cates. A memorial service is planned for Saturday, March 23rd at 12 noon at First Presbyterian Church of Midland, 800 West Texas Avenue, followed by a reception at the church. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. 3 things to know about Texas oil and gas. Number 1. Texas, a global energy giant. Did you know if Texas were its own country, we would be the world's 3rd largest producer of natural gas? That's right. Our state is not just a national leader, but a global powerhouse in natural gas production, contributing massively to both economic and environmental progress worldwide. 2. The journey of Texas LNG. Texas liquefied natural gas, LNG, goes on quite the voyage to get from Texas to across the world. Industry cools natural gas down to a chilly negative 260 degrees Fahrenheit to transform it into LNG, making it easier to ship globally from Texas's LNG export facilities. Once it reaches its destination, LNG is warmed back up, regasification, and distributed for heating, cooking, and powering industries far and wide. 3. Leading the way in environmental progress. Increased use of natural gas has led the U.S. to significant reductions in CO2 emissions, with Texas at the forefront of this cleaner energy revolution. Even more impressive, 99.8% of natural gas produced in Texas is put to beneficial use, and continuous innovation and new technologies continue to drive progress. Martin, Midland counties still dominating oil production. The Railroad Commission reported preliminary crude oil production for December 2023 of 110,727,499 barrels, or 3,571,855 barrels per day. The Commission also reported preliminary natural gas production of 847,732,706 MCF, or 27,346,216 MCF per day. Updated December 2022 production was also provided, with the Commission saying Texas produced 134,959,762 barrels, compared to preliminary reported production of 104,363,178 barrels. Updated natural gas production in December 2022 was 981,638,738 MCF, compared to preliminary reported volume of 813,655,568 MCF. The Commission said production came from 162,725 oil wells and 86,164 natural gas wells. Once again, Martin and Midland counties led the top 10 oil counties. And once again, it wasn't even close. Martin County produced 16,550,000 3,768 barrels in December 2023, closely followed by Midland County with 16,473,470 barrels. The remainder of the top 10 include Howard County with 7,466,556 barrels, Upton County with 6,873,053 barrels, Karnes County, the only non-Permian Basin county in the top 10, with 5,997,097 barrels, Loving County with 4,650,444 barrels, Reagan County with 4,108,931 barrels, Glasscock County with 3,918,763 barrels, Reeves County with 3,835,537 barrels, and Andrews County with 3,321,373 barrels. The Permian Basin also dominated the top 10 total natural gas producing counties, 7 of the top 10. Reeves County topped the list with 78,245,374 MCF, followed by Midland County with 65,312,124 MCF. The remainder of the top 10 include Webb County with 63,681,751 MCF, Panola County with 52,230,296 MCF, Martin County with 43,699,430 MCF, Harrison County with 38,037,998 MCF, Culberson County with 36,460,608 MCF, Loving County with 34,248,116 MCF, Upton County with 28,318,521 MCF, and Howard County with 26,780,286 MCF. Reeves topped the list of top 10 total condensate producing counties with 6,402,163 barrels. Loving County was second with 3,847,302 barrels. The rest of the top 10 include Culberson County with 3,641,108 barrels, Webb County with 1,204,804 barrels, Karnes County with 1,191,476 barrels, DeWitt County with 1,150,700 barrels, Dimmitt County with 690,427 barrels, Live Oak County with 416,525 barrels, Ward County with 359,647 barrels, and LaSalle County with 299,957 barrels. Oil Report. Occidental helps Axis test fully electric service rig. A fully electric well service rig, the oil and natural gas industry's first, is busy reworking production wells for Occidental Petroleum in the Permian Basin. Quote, "It's exciting to be able to partner with Occidental and get into the field," end quote, said Clay Holland, Senior Vice President, Operations at Axis Energy Services. He said it was also exciting for the large number of people who worked on developing the rig. Speaking with the Reporter Telegram by telephone, Holland said the company had done, quote, "a ton of testing," end quote, on its EPIC, electric-powered intervention and completion rig before bringing it to the field. Quote, "Expanding electrification is integral to Oxy's strategy because it contributes to emissions reductions, improves efficiency, creates cost savings, and leverages technology to accelerate our net zero goals," end quote, said Bob Barnes, Senior Vice President of Operations at Oxy, in a statement. Quote, "Of all the advantages of the EPIC rig, we're particularly excited about the different ways it can help us achieve our decarbonization goals," end quote. The rig is designed to operate on battery power or field gas, natural gas, or connection to the public power grid through a transformer. Quote, "The rig itself is designed to run off a certain amount of kilowatts. It doesn't care what those kilowatts are. It's designed to be extremely versatile in the wattage it gets," end quote, Holland said. "The ability to connect to the grid and leverage renewable energy sources can reduce emissions and benefit the environment. But more important is the contributions to safety," he said. "The electric-powered draw works utilizes dynamic breaking, quote, which provides intrinsically safer operations, end quote, said Holland. If the operator running the rig should ever become distracted or for some other reason remove his hand from the controls, the rig will automatically stop, he explained. The rig's built-in programmable logic controller works in conjunction with Axis core data acquisition and analysis platform to provide precision control and enable automated safeguards that reduce manual actions and potential for human error, he added. Quote, it has a myriad of safety elements, end quote, he said. Holland observed that, quote, well servicing is one of the most fragmented industries, and because of that, margins don't allow for innovation. Our partnership with Occidental allowed for that innovation, and we're excited to have a new mousetrap for the market, end quote. As the first rig works under a contract to Occidental, Axis is building at least two subsequent EPIC rigs, one of which will be a completion rig for frac plug drillouts. Quote, we will continue to innovate off this rig, end quote, said Holland. He said that includes looking at the positives and negatives of moving to battery power only. Quote, there are a lot of eyes on this project, end quote, he said. Methane output up in energy sector. Methane emissions from the energy sector neared an all-time high in 2023, but could drop off soon, the International Energy Agency said Wednesday. The Independent Global Energy Authority issued the news along with an update to its annual global methane tracker, calculating that the production and use of fossil fuels produced close to 120 million tons of methane emissions in 2023, up slightly from 2022. It also found that if all companies and countries kept their methane pledges, which spiked following the COP28 climate summit in Dubai, and included a new federal limit announced by President Joe Biden, methane emissions from fossil fuels could be cut in half by 2030. The fate of the U.S. rule is uncertain. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton sued the federal government over its introduction of new rules last week after some small oil producers and state-led regulators expressed concern. The rule had previously gained the support of several major energy companies with Texas footprints, including BP, Oxy, and Equinor. Quote, I am encouraged by the momentum we've seen in recent months, end quote. Fatih Birol, executive director of the IEA, said in a statement. Quote, now we must focus on transforming commitments into action. A 75% cut in methane emissions from fossil fuels by 2030 is imperative to stop the planet from warming to a dangerous level, end quote. The U.S. is the largest global producer of oil and gas and emits the most methane from those operations, followed closely by Russia. Methane from coal power generation also generates a significant percentage of global emissions, of which the largest share is released by China. Emissions of the potent greenhouse gas are not limited to energy production. Landfills are another key source. A recent analysis by the climate nonprofit Industrious Labs found that 75% of industrial methane emissions reported in Texas come from the state's municipal solid waste landfills. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is required to reassess its landfill regulations by August. The agency has declined to respond to questions about Paxton's lawsuit against its new methane rule that will apply to existing operations in the oil and gas industry.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, March 18th. Ketsum edits book of South Africa-themed essays. The story was written by the Odessa American. Long fascinated with the civil rights and anti-apartheid movements, University of Texas Permian Basin Associate Professor of History Derek Ketsum has edited Struggle for a Free South Africa, Campus Anti-Apartheid Movements in Africa and the United States, 1960 to 1994. A collection of essays on campus anti-apartheid movements in Africa and the U.S., the book is geared toward libraries and other institutions. Ketsum is also the Kathleen Cosper Dunnigan Professor in the Humanities at University of Texas Permian Basin. This semester, he's reaching a global sports class using his background as a sports historian to explore international issues. Now that spring is almost here, they are going to throw the rugby ball around and play some cricket. Ketsum also is teaching a graduate course on the 1970s this semester, and in the fall, he will teach his course on the modern presidency and presidential elections. He also has other books and projects in the works. The Struggle for a Free South Africa explores anti-apartheid movements on university and college campuses across Africa and the United States in the 1970s and 1980s. In the wake of the March 1960 Sharpeville massacre in South Africa, the country's apartheid policies drew increasing critical international attention. By the 1970s, South Africa found itself isolated due to growing sporting, economic, and cultural boycotts. Africans across the continent showed solidarity with black South Africans through a range of boycotts and protests, by hosting South Africans exiled from their home country, and by vilifying the apartheid government at every turn. This volume looks at elite institutions as well as state colleges and universities in the United States, and the actions of university students in Nigeria, Kenya, Ghana, and South Africa during the anti-apartheid movements in the 1970s and 1980s, revealing the local manifestations of a global struggle. The chapters showcase how vibrant campus anti-apartheid movements were, what universal problems emerged, and where unique concerns manifested at a wide range of institutions. Taking innovative approaches and offering case studies, Struggle for a Free South Africa reveals the myriad ways the anti-apartheid struggle manifested in a range of academic environments and how those campaigns have been remembered and documented. This book was originally published as a special issue of Safundi. Quote, two books ago was a book on the 1981 Springbok rugby tour to the United States. A lot of what I do is sort of crossover transnational. I've done a lot of the articles and that kind of thing on just South Africa, certainly on a whole wide range of issues on apartheid. In fact, this kind of came about by happenstance, Ketsum said. Doing research, he kept running into student anti-apartheid movements. Campuses big and small across the country were protesting. He got a fellowship at Oberlin College to look at campus anti-apartheid movements. Quote, I spent a week there just doing work on this, and the more I did, the more I realized what a great project it was and how overwhelming it was. The best way to deal with that was to have other people help do the work, so I put out a call for the journal called Safundi that I was on the editorial staff for and did a special issue on campus anti-apartheid, Ketsum said. They liked it so much that they put special issues into books for Routledge, a prominent London academic publisher. Quote, we went through the process and they approved it. Production went really well. The book itself is mostly geared toward libraries and institutional purchases. It's by a factor of five the most expensive book I've ever published, but that's precisely where you want it, he said. He wanted the chapters written by his contributors, both students and professors, to really shine through and have the permanence of a book. Quote, I wrote an introduction to the special issue, and then the introduction carried forward to the book. I talked about the anti-apartheid campaigns at Oberlin, the anti-apartheid campaigns in Stanford and Cal, anti-apartheid campaigns at Williams, my undergraduate alma mater in Massachusetts, and then got all these great responses, four from African universities, one from South Africa, one from Ghana, one from Nigeria, and then a really interesting case in Kenya, movements from University of Florida, from Yale, from people who've been participants in our Internet Scholars, Grand Valley State and Western Michigan, University of North Texas by a former UTPB grad student with me, SUNY Brockport, and then a chapter on Students for a Democratic Society, which we associate with the 60s, and then a real interesting thing on it from an archivist who is at Michigan State and wrote a very fantastic collection on anti-apartheid and in general African liberation stuff. With my introduction, it fits really well. I think it, more than anything, it will fuel future research, I hope. I think there's space for lots and lots and lots of work on this, and I would love for this to be the springboard for it, end quote. Production of the book was relatively fast, taking about 6 months. Quote, I think I probably did the call for papers for the journal in 2021-ish. But the journal came out last year, but I think it's dated 2022 because of COVID issues that delayed journal publication cycles by a year or more. They did a great job. All my contacts at Routledge were really good. The production was super professional, as you'd expect with a major academic publisher, Katzum said. He had finished his master's degree and was just starting his PhD. He had applied for a fellowship from Rotary Foundation that they don't offer anymore. Quote, I got lucky, and I knew I didn't want to spend the year sitting in a pub in Ireland or England, and I knew I didn't want to spend a year just sitting on the beaches in Australia. I wanted to do something that was connected to my work, civil rights, that kind of thing. The obvious one was South Africa. So I went and spent a year at Rhodes University in South Africa and picked up South Africa as a research and eventually teaching field, Katzum said. I was there for a year in 1997. I was there for a few months in 1999. It became a part of my work, and then I've gone back every year other than 2020 because of COVID since 2005. It's a central part of my work. It's a central part of my job and obviously has been fruitful for me in terms of producing. I'm a senior research associate with Rhodes University, which is where I was in 1997 as a postgraduate student on this fellowship, he said. Writing about rugby comes from playing on the Rhodes University team. He had played high school football and ran track in college. He started out at wing on the rugby team. Quote, within literally 1 minute of my first rugby game, I was splayed out on the pitch after being tackled, and it was like everything clicked. I love this. I played for that season that year for the team, and then I came back as a fan, and I started engaging in it more seriously and started writing about it. For the last 10 years, when I go, I usually end up getting media passes and covering the Springboks when they play. I've covered probably a dozen Springbok matches at this point, sort of wearing my journalist hat, and then another bunch of games that you know, professional games and other matches, and then other South African sports, soccer. I did some writing about the World Cup when it was in South Africa in 2010, and then I went to Brazil and wrote a bunch of articles for the newspaper group that appeared in the OA first and foremost, and they were distributed to the other ones. I always had an interest in sports. My first book was on the 2004 Red Sox, sort of labor of love. So that's where South Africa really came about, because I wanted to go abroad and I needed someone else to pay for it, Katzum said. Top UTPB official working toward student-friendly enrollment. The story was written by the Odessa American. With more than 24 years in higher education, Teresa Simpson has taken on a role that's new to her and to University of Texas Permian Basin, Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Management. Part of her job, and that of her team, is to reduce barriers as they explore their college options, give them information, and help them navigate the enrollment process. They go into the high schools weekly, and on some campuses, there is a standing office with a UTPB representative where students can stop by and ask questions. They take that approach with high school and two-year college students. They also work with industry and nonprofits who have employees who want to go back to school and earn credentials, whether that's their first bachelor's degree or a graduate program. Quote, "Our outreach is in all three of those sectors. With my new role, we're just getting started in that space, and it's to take what we're doing and really grow the impact that we're making in equal opportunity for enrollment at UTPB and really serving the needs of the Permian Basin, meeting the needs of a quality workforce," Simpson said. "I have extensive background in student affairs, student retention, recruitment, student success, and community partnerships, and have over 24 years in higher education where I've worked in various pieces of the full enrollment process, more specifically at community partnerships, outreach, early engagement, recruitment, and retention," Simpson said. Right now, UTPB serves about 7,500 students annually. Quote, "We are going to continue to grow that. In order to do that, I am working with the leadership team at UTPB, and we are building out what we refer to as a modern enrollment management model. What that will allow for us to do is to fully build out recruitment. As we are recruiting already at the high schools and the two-year colleges, and we're working with our industry partners, we will further develop that infrastructure so that we can do that with greater impact," Simpson said. "Community partnership is critical to my role and teaming up with the current roles that are already in that space. The stronger our partnerships are, the more we can align with our common goals, and we can reduce barriers and close gaps in creating access through early engagement initiatives and create seamless pathways for our students to achieve their career goals," she added. In reference to building partnerships, she said she is talking not only about creating partnerships in the Permian Basin, but also internally to make for a smooth student experience. This will include making terminology more clear to students. Quote, "With the infrastructure development that's taking place, I think it's important to note we are investing in a one-stop shop. That falls within this role as well, so when students are a future Falcon and they're looking to start their journey at UTPB, they're not having to go to different parts of the university. They're actually having to come to one spot here in the Mesa building. We will have great individuals that will make sure that they get where they need to go, so we come to them. They don't have to go all over the campus to find those places of support," Simpson said. The one-stop shop will be in the first floor of the Mesa building with a reception area. Through that one-stop shop desk that is part of the campus transformation, UTPB will bring the right people to them," Simpson said. The renovation will start in April and is expected to take about 6 months. Part of the transformation also includes making Maple Avenue the main entrance to the university. Literally meeting the students where they are is the most important common denominator. Quote, "Over 50% of our students are first-generation college students. We want to make sure that we meet our students where they are. They know where they're supposed to go, and if not, we can get to them sooner in just a physical space to help them navigate that process," Simpson said. Students coming in this year will see the campus transform through a multi-million-dollar reconfiguration of the campus. Quote, it'll be finished before they're done, and how exciting to be a Falcon that's gone through that process, Simpson said. A proud first-generation student herself, Simpson said her passion is to support students that don't think college is possible and make that a reality. Simpson is from Beaumont and went to a two-year college and then transferred to University of Houston Clear Lake, which was a junior-senior campus at the time. She was a double major in history and literature and started her career as a teacher and coach and wanted to go back to her town to show them going to college is possible. At Lamar College, she earned her master's and doctorate in educational leadership. Although the surroundings are somewhat different in Odessa than Beaumont, Simpson said the industry culture is very similar. Quote, I know this community. I know the people. I know the industry. The UTPB, where we are as an institution, and what that looks like for the Permian Basin, I'm just really excited to be a part of and to build with this community, Simpson said. She added that it is truly an honor to be the first one to take on the Assistant Vice President for Enrollment Management position. Quote, this role, outside of my specific leadership, is a true testament to the growth that this university is in right now. To take the impact opportunities that we're currently making available and to be able to build upon that is a huge opportunity. I'm very honored to be the one that's leading that, Simpson said. She and her husband, Dr. Art Simpson, have two children. He is in higher education as well, and his background is in recreational sports like track and field. Becky Spurlock, Senior Vice President of Student Affairs and Enrollment Management, is thrilled to have Simpson on board. Quote, Dr. Simpson brings a wealth of experience in areas critical to enrollment and student success to UT Permian Basin. Her passion for partnerships, her success in working with K-12, and her deep understanding of the power of data will no doubt help UTPB continue to grow our enrollment. She is ready to serve West Texas, Spurlock said.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.